This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It isn't easy getting on the ballot if you are a member of a third party. There's a big difference in petition signature requirements for Democrats and Republicans and, say, libertarians like Illinois House candidate Christopher Howick.
All they have to get is 0.5 of their vote in the previous election cycle, whereas I'm going to have to get 5% of the entire vote in the previous election cycles. That, for myself, that equates to a minimum of 2,500 signatures. For them, it equates to a minimum of 400 to 500 signatures.
GLT's Ryan Denham explores ballot access issues. And a 13-year-old eighth grader at Chittick's Junior High in Normal is one of the youngest licensed ham radio operators in the country. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you've ever voted in McLean County, you may have been struck by how few options you have on your ballot. There are usually lots of uncontested races. That's a window into a complicated world of ballot access. It's an issue that has taken on new urgency as McLean County Libertarians try to make some noise and some inroads against the two-party system. GLT's Ryan Denham sat down with McLean County Libertarian Party Chair Bennett Morris, who's running for McLean County Board, and Libertarian candidate for Illinois House, Christopher Howick.
The established party candidates, that being established parties, are those that get more than 5% of the vote in previous election cycles. They are required to get 0.5% of their vote totals.
When you're talking about signatures for their
signatures.
Nominating petitions.
Correct. For independents and new political parties. I say new in that that's the term that the state uses. Our party's been around since 1971. Those candidates are required to get 5%, so that's more than 10 times as much, for the total vote in the previous election, which is extremely difficult. So these laws are created by the two old parties to keep themselves in power. And really hinders the public's ability to get more choices on the ballot. The two old parties are 100% the cause of all of our political turmoil in our country, our state, and locally. And I think most Americans think that there should be, and actually a Gallup poll this week said 61% of Americans think that we need more party options, and that the two-party system is no longer viable.
So, Chris, you're running for the Illinois House District 88 seat. That's currently held by State Representative Keith Sommer, a Republican.
Yes.
Democrat Joe Blair is also in that race.
Yes.
Tell me about what these laws that Bennett has described, what has that meant for you? Is you're going to be going out and getting signatures for your nominating petitions? How many is that versus your opponents in this race, Keith Sommer, Joe Blair?
Well, again, as Bennett pointed out, all they have to get is 0.5 of their vote in the previous election cycle, whereas I'm going to have to get 5% of the entire vote in the previous election cycles. That, for myself, that equates to a minimum of 2,500 signatures. For them, it equates to a minimum of 400 to 500 signatures. Now, one thing we do hear a lot of from the old parties is you hear a lot from the Democrats about electoral fairness. For example, in the last general election, they won the popular vote but lost the presidency. You also hear a lot from Republicans about voter fraud. To me, what is the biggest fraud and the biggest unfairness is that we have to jump through hoops, obstacles all over the place simply to give people an extra choice on the ballot.
Gotcha. And 2,500 signatures, that is the minimum. So you got to go above and beyond that pretty much to make sure you don't get challenged off the ballot.
We estimate that I'm probably going to need double that.
And that's not, I mean, that's not easy either to go out and get signatures. I mean, tell our listeners who may not know what signature collection is like, what it's like to stand outside grocery stores or go to your neighbor's houses. What is that like?
It's a thankless task because you've got to go out in all weathers, all kinds of days. You've got to ask hundreds, just simply to get 100 signatures, you're probably going to have to ask 1,000 people.
And speaking from the state party, our statewide candidates will require probably 50,000 in order to get on the ballot. That undertaking takes up almost all of our entire budget every 2 years that we want to put people on the ballot. That includes the presidential election in 2016, and it includes the candidates that are running for statewide office, including governor, next year. Next year, we will probably spend 90% of our budget on ballot access, which is basically hiring people to come into Illinois to gather signatures, because it would be impossible for us to get that many volunteers to go out and get those petition signatures. Because it's not only you got to be registered to vote, but you also have to be in that particular area for that petition. So for statewide office, it's a lot easier for that because you find Illinois residents. For county board district, you have to get it in that district. For state representative, you can't just go to the post office here in Normal and collect signatures, because there are several representative seats in this area.
And specifically within the district that I'm running, District 88 is a very strange district in that it takes in part of Bloomington, and then it kind of spreads out west in a very thin line. It takes in Washington, Morton. It goes as far west as Mackinac, but it doesn't hit Pekin. So a lot of people don't even know necessarily which district they are in.
Bennett, you're going to be running for McLean County Board District 7. What are your signature requirements? I understand they're a little less onerous than for Chris here on the State House side. And I guess talk about that and why they're less onerous based on the 5% that you guys hit last time around.
Yeah. So, you mentioned the last election cycle. Both our comptroller, state Senate and presidential candidate all got 5% in McLean County, which is great. That, according to the candidate's guide that the State Board of Election puts out, makes us an established party in McLean County. And we will be running with those signature requirements. That is why it is extremely important that people who are frustrated with the two old parties that have ruined our state and country, it is extremely important that they come out and vote for candidates based on their positions on the issues and based on their principles, not based on whether they think the Republicans or Democrats are worse. Both of them are bad for our for our country. And so when you are getting these candidates on the ballot for whether it's the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or Independent, it is important that people voice their vote not based on the fear tactics that the old parties portray, which is that you're wasting your vote. You're not wasting your vote. You are helping change the state of Illinois and our country by getting to that 5% threshold, so that new parties can be established and so that they can spend their time and money reaching out to you, the voter, rather than paying these petitioners to come in to to reach these obscene signature requirements.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Today we're talking ballot access with members of the McLean County Libertarian Party. We also asked a few experts to weigh in on the issue. Here's Carrie Melita, an assistant professor and election expert from Illinois State University's Department of Politics and Government.
Illinois is a bit on the restrictive side. Illinois tends to be very hostile to, minor parties, we call them, anything other than a Democrat and Republican. It's one of the more restrictive states in the country as far as how tough they make it for non-major parties to get onto the ballot. You had probably found in your research, like, the signature requirement is much higher for minor party members to get on the ballot than it is for a Democrat or Republican.
Ostensibly, what's the reason for these higher signature requirements?
The rhetoric that a major party would tell you is that there is some evidence, or you clutter ballots, you can discourage not turnout, but you can encourage abstention. That if people turn out to vote and you've got to flip through a couple of pages to find your candidate, the harder you make it for people to cast their vote, the more likely that they are to abstain, even though they've turned out to vote, right? Not to vote on a particular ballot race. So that's often the rationale that they use, is that it by reducing the number of people running for a particular office, you are discouraging abstention. Which I suppose I can buy to an extent, but the real reason is to protect their duopoly.
Ron Michelson is the former executive director of the State Board of Elections. He says the courts have generally felt that this was a policy matter best left to the legislature.
Be that as it may, there's been very little activity in the legislature to try to change these ballot access requirements. Because obviously the way we conduct our politics here, it's not for the faint of heart, and neither Republicans or Democrats in the legislature are interested in making it easier for having independents and or new party candidates run for office, i.e. make a run at them. There hasn't been a lot of enthusiasm in the legislature to change it, for sure. But it's been a pretty tough road in the courts as well. But frankly, if it is going to be changed, the judicial process is probably the more likely route, because there just is very little interest amongst incumbents in the state legislature.
That's Ron Michelson, the former executive director of the State Board of Elections. Before that was Carrie Melita from ISU's Department of Politics and Government, as well as Christopher Howick and Bennett Morris from the McLean County Republican Party. I'm Ryan Denham.
While it may seem a bit early to be talking elections, the primary is right around the corner in March, followed by the general election next November. For more kind of too early election coverage, try our website, WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a conversation with a young ham radio operator thrilled at the prospect of talking to someone in space. Little did Julie Weger know what was in store for her when she agreed to tag along with her brother to play darts for his team in Paris, Illinois, 20 years ago. International travel, national team representation, world rankings. GLT's Brian Bloodworth found out when he caught up with Weger at the American Legion.
I got involved with darts with my brother in a little bar in Paris, Illinois, and I've been playing for 20 years this December.
But how did that come about?
He needed a sub for a league one night and couldn't find anyone, so took me to the bar, because of course I wasn't old enough yet, and it just went from there.
What has happened? What has transpired? I understand you've got numerous trophies, plaques.
Yes. I moved to Peoria not long after that and joined a league up there and became competitive locally, and then started traveling within the state and surrounding states and doing quite well, and it's grown over the years. I played my first U.S. competition my third year in 2000 in Florida, and we won. I've been on the USA team now for the last 5 years for International NDA in Vegas.
Now you say we.
When you play for USA, it's a four-person team event. The international event in Las Vegas for NDA is actually a women's team. There's eight girls on the team, four permanents and four alternates. The actual international overseas event, there's four people on a team, but there's three guys and one girl.
Where all have you traveled with this, and where is this taking you?
I just went to Hong Kong in March. That was my first international overseas event. I'm going back this coming March, and I would really like to go to Spain in April, and there's a possibility of going to Korea in July.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
it really is. I mean, did you all of a sudden just try to set goals? I mean, was it just because you won a few, you had some success, and it's kind of like, oh, I just want to move it to the next level?
The ICMOA used to be in Illinois. I know they're still around, the Illinois Coin Machine Operators Association. They were the sponsors for Illinois State, which we haven't had an Illinois State for several years. But it started with State. State was the biggest tournament I ever played in, and after winning a few times and getting some firsts under my belt, it just kind of expanded, and then I started winning more and more.
For somebody like me that doesn't know a lot about it, can you explain what you do, what's involved with the game? And
when I first started out, most women only played 301, which is shooting the bullseye. Now, I play double in, double out, 01. Typically, it's 501. And it's true, double in, double out, no bull in, no bull out, and then cricket.
You got to back up. What's 301?
301, you start, your score starts at 301, and you work down, and you have to go to zero.
So the numbers on the board indicate if you hit that, then
correct.
You get that number.
Six
off.
Darts in 301 is perfect game.
Okay.
So you would hit three bullseyes, and then two bullseyes, and a triple 17.
And then you went to 501?
Now I've moved up because of the level that I play at now. I typically play 501, double in, double out, and cricket. Double in, double out is the outer ring of a dartboard, is the double. You have to hit that before your score will register and be subtracted from 501. Then you go to the bullseye, which is 50 points. Work your way down, and then you have to hit the double ring to go out.
And cricket is?
Cricket is 20s, 19s, 18s, 17s, 16, 15 in the bullseye. It's more of a strategy game. You have to have three marks on each number to close out the game, but in order to win, you also have to have the higher amount of points. You can score on a number as long as the person that you're playing against does not have it closed out.
You're listening to Sound Ideas with Brian Bloodworth, and we're talking with Julie Wieger, an international dart player. So do you practice?
I do not. I used to. I don't anymore. I just don't have time.
Does it just come natural then?
Now it's just pretty much muscle memory. I still love the game of darts. I used to get really, really excited. I couldn't wait to go to tournaments and play, and I still love to go and travel and play. I just don't get quite as excited as I used to.
Is that a sad thing?
I think it's just a growing up thing.
Now, how many years have you been on the Team USA?
I think it'll be my fifth year.
Are they all from Illinois, your team members?
No, they're from across the U.S.
Is there strategy involved?
Cricket's a huge strategy game. 01's pretty straightforward. You hit the bullseye or you don't.
Do you have strategy within your teammates? I mean, when you're playing with a team?
Not really. It just depends on what gets hit. Like, you can't really plan anything because every round's different.
And how many rounds are involved in a
Depending on what tournament you're at, some cricket games are 20 rounds and other cricket games are 35 rounds. There's different rules for different tournaments.
What's the greatest place you've been? I mean, was there the coolest tournament you've been in?
Hong Kong was by far amazing. It was something else.
How many teams are involved in an international event?
The Hong Kong tournament, there were 16 countries represented that actually played in the international competition. So that's four-person team, one woman, three men. And we ended up taking third. We lost to Japan. It was all double in, double out. I think I played the Super One on Saturday over there. And that takes the one female from the international team, from each international team, and one of the males. And you play singles.
How did they choose the international team? How were you selected to play?
There's several girls that travel across the U.S. that go international. A lot of it just depends on who's got the funding to go at the time when the tournament is.
How many tournaments do you play around the U.S.?
I go to Kansas City in 2 weeks. Okay. That's a big one.
How many do you play a year? Any idea? How many weekends a year you travel and play in?
Tournaments? A good guesstimate would probably be one a month.
Now, do you have to support your, quote, habit, or do you get funding?
To a certain extent, I do have a sponsor from Japan. That's Cosmo Fit Flight. I am a product player for them.
What do you mean by the product player?
They give me the product that I use as to promote them in the U.S. My darts are theirs, except for my barrels.
So is Japan a big proponent of darts? I mean, are they
Japan's
the biggest?
Huge, probably. Cosmo and L-Style are both out of Japan. They're probably the two largest dart product companies right now. They're both enormous.
Playing forever and ever and ever, or what's the...
I'm sure there's a retirement somewhere in my future. I haven't hit that mark yet. I still like to play.
I was going to say, do you get burnt out at some point?
Sometimes I have to take a break now. I think that comes with age, but I still like to play. I have a competitive streak in me, so.
So were you athletic, play sports before you played darts, younger, in high school, things like that?
I played volleyball, and I played softball for 14 years growing up, and I'm bold.
So you got a competitive nature in you? And darts is just kind of taking it over.
Darts is just taking over.
What was your thought when your brother asked you to come play?
I wasn't very good. He knew I wasn't going to be very good. Like, he didn't care. He just needed a body to play. And
how long did it take you to get good?
A couple of years. I just progressively started getting better and better, and my sprees kept getting higher and higher. And
were you hooked the first time you played?
Yeah, it was fun. I had a really good time.
And then it kind of spurred you on to say, you know what, I want to keep playing, I want to keep getting better.
Yeah.
And, all right, well, hey, good luck to you coming up.
Thanks. Kansas City's a big one.
Julie Weger is an internationally ranked darts player. She works for the town of Normal. Weger spoke with GLT's Brian Bloodworth at the Legion Hall.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, my name's Pat Sheridan, and I started giving to GLT because I'm both an engineer and a musician. I like my news to be without skew. GLT and NPR seem to be pretty straightforward. What are the facts? And let's take it from there. I'm a big fan of roots music, and there's a wide variety of powerful music at work in this country where a lot of the ideas are generated. The roots is what I like. GLT delivers. Join me now in making a first-time contribution right here and right now. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
We're trying hard this fund drive to avoid interrupting programs to ask for your support, but we're about running 20% shy of having enough listener support to pay the program bills. You can help close the gap, help pay for Sound Ideas, and keep fundraising to a minimum. Give $10 a month or what works for you now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. At the end of the month, students at Chittix Junior High School in Normal will get the chance of a lifetime. Chittix has been selected as one of 11 schools or educational centers nationwide and the only one in Illinois where students will be able to speak with astronauts aboard the International Space Station. They'll do this through a ham radio transmission. The project was the brainchild of Dhruv Reba, a 13-year-old eighth grader who is one of the youngest licensed ham radio operators in the country. GLT's Judy Valente has more.
One of the first things you notice when you visit Dhruv Reba's home in Normal is a mantelpiece full of his trophies. He's received awards for academics, service, and leadership, for designing and building robots, for karate. He's a first-degree black belt, for chess and cross-country track.
Warning. We have a storm warning. A low at 46 north, 46 west at minor 2.
But it's at a desk in the corner of his family's spacious basement where Dhruv engages his true passion, ham radio operating.
There's so much you can learn with it. And so you can learn like electronic components and like radio propagation and like how sound waves work and radio frequencies. And there's so many new people you can meet.
He earned his general operator's license when he was 9. Dhruv inherited this hobby from his father, Hari, a State Farm analyst and avid ham radio operator.
My dad was going to Dayton, Ohio for a ham radio convention, and I wanted to come with. And I came and I got inspired by the convention. And later that summer, I got my license.
At the time, the Limca Book of Records cited him as the youngest person of Asian Indian descent ever to earn a general class license. He was also one of the youngest ham radio operators in America. Dhruv said he saw at that convention in Ohio how useful ham radios can be, even in the age of ubiquitous cell phones. He says he found further evidence of that during Hurricane Harvey and Irma as they swept through Texas and Florida, and later when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico.
Especially in Puerto Rico, like they didn't have much communication there, so they used ham radio a lot for communication since the cell phone towers are down. And ham radio transmits the frequencies like wirelessly. It's not like cell phone towers where it goes to the tower and then the tower takes care of the rest through fiber optics.
So have you been in touch with hurricane survivors through your ham radio work?
I unfortunately couldn't help with that because I'm not old enough. Like I asked, but they said no.
Dhruv was just the right age, however, for a project called Amateur Radio on the International Space Station. The program, known as ARIS, allows a select number of students from various countries to speak via ham radio to astronauts on board the orbiting station.
So at the hamvention a few years ago, I met astronaut Douglas Wheelock, and he told me that I should look into the ARIS program, and I looked at it and I talked to them on like how to send the application in. It took us a few tries to get accepted, so like we tried a few years ago and they rejected us first, and then we tried again and then they accepted us.
Chittix's second application got a boost from partnering with the Children's Discovery Museum and the Challenger Learning Center at Heartland Community College. Stacy Shrewsbury of the Challenger Center says the space station call will be a once-in-a-lifetime event for the students.
To be able to ask questions of those astronauts and get a real answer from them, not just something that they looked up online or something that maybe they read in a book about that astronaut.
Dhruv is already working on his questions.
How does like the lack of gravity affect you in space, and what do you miss most about, like, not being at Earth?
Dhruv will make the initial contact with the station, but then other students from a variety of schools who attended a summer space camp at the Challenger Learning Center will also get involved. Dee Hopper is a science teacher at Chittix.
We will have 12 students from Chittix and 4 from the Challenger Learning Center who will be involved. Those will be the students who will get to directly ask their questions. And then we'll have other students observing. And then we're going to do a live feed so the entire school will get to hear it. And I hope that it'll just be a connection for them between real life and real scientists and what real cool scientists do and what we do in the classroom every day.
The school doesn't know yet the exact date or time the call will take place. NASA has said it will be sometime between October 23rd and 29th. The time of the call depends largely on when the space station will pass over local ham radio antennas on the ground in central Illinois. Shrewsbury of the Challenger Center says there will only be a 10-minute window in which the students can communicate with the space station.
We have that 10-minute window because that is the time in which the International Space Station is within range of the antenna that will be at Chittix Junior High to receive that signal.
There are 3 astronauts on board, Paolo Nespoli, an Italian, and Joseph Acaba and Mark Vandehay, both Americans. Acaba was the first person of Puerto Rican heritage to become an astronaut candidate. NASA has struggled in recent years under budget cuts and declining public interest in space exploration. Dee Hopper, the Chittix science teacher, says she hopes projects like this one that involves students will fuel an interest in space travel in the next generation.
The space program is just hugely instrumental to all kinds of advances in all kinds of areas. A lot of the inventions that we have were first invented for the space program. It's just that sense of exploration. I think it's vitally important that we continue to support it.
As for Dhruv Rebba, he says one of his favorite subjects is science, but he doesn't think he wants to be an astronaut. He would like to work in the area of technology.
I am interested in, like, fiber optic cables and, like, how they work.
And he'll keep communicating with people from all over the world, and one day soon from above the Earth on his basement ham radio. I'm Judy Valente.
Dhruv Rebba seemed to predestined to put others in touch with the stars. His name in Telugu, in East Indian language, means pole star. Stay tuned for an update. GLT will bring you that conversation between Chittix students and the space station on the day it occurs. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Gambler 500 finally came to Illinois. Don't know it? It's a 500-mile road rally that was first held in Oregon and is spreading across the nation. IPR's Carl Nelson rode shotgun for the first ever Illinois rally.
The story of the first Illinois Gambler 500 begins a couple weeks ago. I ran into a good friend of mine that I hadn't seen in probably 7 years. His name is Tom. Now, Tom's an engineer. He's a gearhead. You might say he's a bit of an adrenaline junkie. Tom told me about this road rally called the Gambler 500, or just the Gambler for short. I immediately knew that I had to tag along. Now, what is the Gambler 500? Well, it sounds simple enough. The goal is to drive 500 miles in a car that costs $500. There's more to it than that, of course. This is about a community of car enthusiasts coming together to have some fun and take a gamble on some old vehicles that might have otherwise gone to the junkyard, all while exploring some parts of the state they may have never seen. So Tom shows up to my house to pick me up the morning of the Gambler in a flat black 1965 Chevy Corvair, a Monza for all you Corvair nerds. Well, technically, it was only a Corvair from the waist up. The frame, the drivetrain, engine, all of that was from a 1993 Blazer. Tom bought it like that. It was Frankenstein's monster, if Frankenstein was a fan of road rallies and American steel. The Gambler started at 6 a.m. at an auto parts store in LaSalle. Tom was at a wedding party the night before, so we were late to join. We had a stop to make before catching up with the rest of the group.
This is the off-road park in Seneca. Pretty crazy off-road areas. There we go, here's our first car.
Let's see what these fine gentlemen need.
We were here to help rescue a fellow gambler. The car they were driving was a 1997 Crown Victoria. It had a lift kit, the doors were ripped off, and there was a big gas-powered generator ratchet strapped to the roof. You could hear it running as we rolled up to the scene.
Right now what we're doing is we're running a generator on the roof to run a battery charger to charge the batteries to make up for the lack of an alternator. I'm just going to run the generator going down the road, call it good.
Everything under the hood of this Crown Vic was coated in dried mud. It took them about 10 or 15 minutes to get it scraped clean enough to get a solid electrical connection. Finally, with the help of our Corvair battery, and with that, we had started our journey off with a good deed. Good karma, so to speak.
I mean, you gotta help these people out because you don't know when that's gonna be you. I think there's definitely a pay it forward atmosphere about this kind of thing. Because, I mean, they're all $500 cars. You really don't know what's going on with them.
I am a roving gambler. I've gambled down.
Our next goal was to catch up with the rest of the group. They were already a couple of counties away. The route of the gambler was released the morning of the rally. It was a spreadsheet full of numbers, latitude and longitude coordinates, arranged in order. These different waypoints would take you through an all-day route that snaked through the northern part of the state, from LaSalle to Freeport, Galena to Rock Island. The rest of the group was currently approaching Freeport.
Should be right there. Yep, here's another one.
We had finally caught up with the rest of the group, and we made our way through the next couple of waypoints in a mini convoy. West of Lena, we came to a dirt road occupied by a cluster of fellow gamblers. It looked like a scene out of Mad Max. There was a group crowded around a bright orange Saab with a Swedish flag painted on top.
Tell me about your vehicle here.
It's a 1990 Saab 900S. We decided to make it a Swedish theme General Lee.
So it's called?
The General Bork, complete with a Swedish flag on the roof.
We were trying to blend the culture of Sweden with American 80s pop culture with the General Lee, so we came up with the General Bork. We just really like the Dukes of Hazzard and the Muppet Show, so we tried to blend the two together, and this is what we came up with.
Speaking of Muppets, there was another vehicle there. It was a Land Rover covered in blue fur.
Your vehicle have a name here?
It's Land Rover.
The Land Rover.
There was another group crowded around a disabled Mercedes.
This wonderful gentleman right here decided to take it down that gravel path and slammed a hole in the oil pan because he was trying to keep up with another vehicle.
Apparently people were trying their hand at making it down this steep, rutted gravel road. Not to be outdone, Tom made the executive decision that we would try. I didn't get the option to opt out. We had a problem. In Tom's enthusiasm to conquer this dirt road, he had gotten our Corvair high-sided, high-centered, bottomed-out, whatever you want to call it. We were straddling a dirt embankment, spinning our wheels, miles away from the nearest service station. We were stuck. Right then, we heard an engine coming up behind us. It was a Geo Metro. Certainly not a tow truck by any means, but it was somebody. Dylan and Tall Bill did rallycross, and they were confident that they could help. First, we tried shoving rocks and sticks under the tires to get traction, but it wasn't working. Our last chance was to bring the Metro around front of the Corvair and tow it out. We needed to push the Corvair from behind as well. This was an all-hands-on-deck situation.
Yeah, baby, yeah!
Woo, woo!
That's what I'm talking about when I'm in America!
We survived and we were humbled. Tall Bill reassured us.
We help each other out. That's the whole thing. Whether it's State Line Rallycross or whether it's, doing the Gambler 500 or any sort of racing, you find it's the nicest people in the world, and all we want to do is help each other out because the next time it's going to be us that's stuck, and that's all we do, man. Help each other out.
Thank you.
No problem. No problem at all. You're welcome.
We made our way down the Mississippi River to the final waypoint for the day, Cordova International Speedway, just north of the Quad Cities. It was quite a sight, a bunch of post-apocalyptic junkyard cars making their way through rows of $500,000 top fuel dragsters. But there was a common thread.
It doesn't matter if you have a $50,000 car or a $500 car.
it's the spirit of what you're doing. The getting out there, I guess the combination of man and machine, and no matter what it is, it's a beautiful thing that I think we all understand it. We all can come together with this. They let us stay here, they invited us in, because I think they really understand what this is all about.
From a dirt road somewhere in northern Illinois, I'm Carl Nelson.
You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up, know when to walk away, and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Prairie Fire Theater explores romantic relationships in an intimate review. Laura Kennedy has more in this GLT Datebook.
Prairie Fire Theater presents Starting Here, Starting Now, a musical review of the songs of Richard Maltby and David Shire. Performances are October 20th at 7:30 p.m. and the 21st at 3 and 7:30 p.m. in the Young Lounge of the IWU Memorial Center. Joe Penrod performs in the show that's directed by Cindy Brown. And she says reluctance on the part of the composer almost stalled the project before it even started.
Someone got together with Maltby and Shire, originally proposing this project. Why don't you take some of the songs, some of these great songs from shows that you have written that haven't really had the chance maybe to be heard. Maltby immediately kind of jumped on board, and Shire kind of went, oh no, I don't think this is a really good idea. This is like, you know, exhuming and examining a body, and he just didn't want to do that. And
right.
But it turned out to, I think it was the Manhattan Club,
mm-hmm.
where they staged it in 1976, mm-hmm. a very small, intimate kind of space. It was a hit. After writing this show, then came Baby, right? And some of their other Broadway things.
I think they were classmates at Yale, I believe. Mm-hmm. David Shire, who is the composer, had really started writing soundtracks for film and television. But all the time he was doing that, he was also collaborating with Richard Maltby in the musical theater world.
Joe, tell us what the appeal of a review is.
What attracts me to this show is the nature of the writing. Many of them are story songs, character songs. It stands all by itself and is a small little 3.5-minute drama.
So basically, this is not you up on the stage singing a song. You're inhabiting the song as a character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, come from the world originally of doing classical music, and I did a lot of recital work. And we always talked about recitals being an opportunity to do 25 little dramas over the course of an evening. I think this show is a lot like that. Every one of these songs, although there is some linkage and some overall overarching trends, the songs also stand so securely just by themselves.
Cindy, tell me about this linkage. How are you making all this hang together and make it a show, not just just sort of a potpourri, as it were?
I think, a lot of that for me is embedded in the script and in the way that they have, I guess I can use the word prescribed, that the order that the songs be performed in. Mm-hmm. And so they've actually, for example, at the beginning of, towards the beginning of the first act, they've also talked, they talk about this mini plot. And there are these five songs that in a way are connected and kind of spin out this mini plot about love, discovering it, experiencing it, and then breaking away from it, breaking up with someone, moving on, so to speak. But there are then kind of individual links that can happen too between the songs, just from one to the other. But you know, as I was reading something here, they talk about, you know, the fact that there is that arc, this connectedness of, let's tell this wonderful story about people discovering and feeling things that we have all discovered mm-hmm. and felt. And one thing for an audience, too, it's like, well, if you don't like one song, you know, there's 24 others coming in about 3 minutes,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there's a lovely variety in these songs. I talk about, you know, love and breaking up and all that. But there's so many just fun kinds of things, obviously sprinkled throughout. It's a lovely, lovely evening with three of the most talented performers I've ever worked with. It's awesome.
Okay, Cindy, tell me about the rest of your cast.
Also, with Joe Penrod, we have Jennifer Rusk, who, again, is an amazing performer that I think a lot of people in this community have experienced, and Kristen Monson, who has also done, I think, a lot of work. She's worked at Heartland. She's worked with Prairie Fire. When she was a graduate student at ISU, she was on the stages there.
She's done Community Players.
She comes from a professional background of sorts before she came here to us. So these are three performers that understand music, understand theater, understand an aspect of performance that connects emotion and song. To have three such extraordinary performers who can make these emotional connections and share that with an audience, as I said, I think is going to make for just a lovely, lovely evening.
That's Cindy Brown and Joe Penrod. Starting Here, Starting Now is October 20th at 7:30 p.m. and the 21st at 3 and 7:30 p.m. in the Young Lounge of the Illinois Wesleyan University Memorial Center. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Director Cindy Brown is very busy these days. She's also just recently performed as part of the Evergreen Cemetery Walk in Bloomington. This fund drive is running about 20% behind where it needs to be to meet the program budget. Please help make sure we have enough listener support to pay for the GLT and NPR programs you count on. Help close the gap. Renew or make your first-time contribution right now. Contribute $10 a month or whatever amount you choose at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's no secret that Illinois remains in financial distress with the ongoing pension crisis, bill backlog, and near-junk status credit rating. This summer, lawmakers approved an income tax hike. Historically, they've been unwilling to make tough choices needed to get the state back on solid footing. For Illinois Issues, political science professor Christopher Mooney offers some insights on why. He talked with Mary Hansen about a recent Paul Simon Institute survey of how state residents feel about raising taxes.
The kind of taxes that most people pay that the state basically relies on largely are ones that people oppose raising, right? Income tax, gas tax, that sort of thing. What they don't mind, at least they mind less raising, are taxes that are more focused on individual kind of people that maybe they don't fall into that category, right? So they want, you know, they'd like to see gambling taxes increased, or they'd like to see millionaires' taxes increased, or they, you know, that sort of thing.
That brings us to the other side of the budget equation. How do they feel about spending?
You know, when you ask people, should government spending be increased or decreased, they largely say, decrease government spending, because it's kind of a vague, amorphous idea. You know, it seems like it's just bureaucracy, or it's just something that does something for somebody else. But if you start breaking it down on particular policy areas, then attitudes change dramatically. While they would love to see government spending cut in general, they don't want these particular programs cut. And the problem is that government spending, writ large, is made up of all these particular programs.
How does economic theory help us understand why Illinoisans have somewhat conflicting views?
There's a particular thing when you're talking about public goods, and that's what we're talking about here in this case. When you're talking about public education, when you're talking about public safety, when you talk about natural resources, as opposed to where if I go out on the street and I buy a hot dog, I'm making all the choices about the hot dog. I know what hot dog I want. I'm going to put ketchup on there if I want to. I don't care what anybody in Chicago says. And I'm going to eat that hot dog, and I'm going to pay the price for the hot dog, and I'm going to get all the benefit for that hot dog. That's just the way it is in the private market. Like I can keep you from eating my hot dog, I can't keep people from attending school or getting police services if I don't particularly want to. It's sort of we're all in this together, and that's the idea of the public good, right? There are some things that we need to get together and do collectively, and that's why we've developed these institutions of government over the years to help us make those sorts of decisions, and that's what government is there to do.
What do these views on taxes and spending mean for lawmakers or policymakers and the job that they need to do?
So policymakers are faced with, you know, a bit of a dilemma. What they're trying to do is represent the wishes of their constituents, but constituents' wishes are a little bit schizophrenic here, right? They don't want to increase revenue, but they would love to increase spending. And the sort of areas of revenue that they particularly don't like are the ones that are most efficient and that actually get, you know, substantial amounts of revenue. So policymakers are a little bit in a bind at that point.
So what can lawmakers do when their constituents want both lower taxes and more spending?
You know, the way you can get around this public goods problem and this free riders problem is to make people understand that, yes, even though maybe I'm not getting a benefit of this particular policy at this particular moment, I might in the future get benefit from it, or I might get benefit from some other policy. So, this is all of us pitching in together. And when politicians denigrate political institutions that are there to try to make these decisions, when they, you know, pander to voters' misunderstandings, when they exacerbate regional tensions, those are things that go in the opposite direction.
That was Christopher Mooney, political science professor at the University of Illinois at Springfield, talking with IPR's Mary Hansen. Tomorrow in Sound Ideas, the Magpie Salute, birds of a feather making music together. GLT's John Norton talks with Rich Robinson of the Magpie Salute ahead of their Friday night concert at the Castle Theater. Here's their cover of Pink Floyd's Fearless from their self-titled debut album. The Magpie Salute tomorrow on Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Find the full Sound Ideas podcast also at WGLT.org, including today's stories from Judy Valenti, Ryan Denham, and Brian Bloodworth. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.